Fisher Body Historical Team interview. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2006. The time is approximately 11:24. First, we're at UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. We will first begin with giving the interview team.
Earl Nicholson.
Cheryl McQuay.
Jerry Smith.
John Fedewa.
Doug Rademacher.
Gary Judy.
And Marilyn Coulter. Today, we're here with Derek Quinney. Derek, will you please spell and pronounce your name for us?
My name is Derek Quinney, B-E-R-R-I-C-K, Q-U-I-N-N-E-Y.
Your address, please.
2010 Wellesley, W-E-L-L-E-S-L-E-Y, Drive, Lansing, Michigan, 48910.
How much seniority do you have?
27 years.
Are you married?
Married with two children.
And boys, girls?
Boy and a girl.
Were you raised in Michigan? Where were you born?
Originally born in Bossier City, Louisiana. Came to Michigan in 1957 with my dad. My family migrated here from Louisiana. My dad came here with the hopes of getting a job in the North in the auto industry. That's how it all began.
Well, what education level do you have?
Product of the public schools here in Lansing. Some union education, of course, as well as 2 years at LCC and life experiences.
Any military?
No military. In fact, it's quite interesting. I'm glad you asked that. Also, during the time of the Vietnam War, is when my eligibility for the military became active, and it was during that time, and I turned 18 in April of 73, and in May of 73 is when President Nixon brought the troops home from Vietnam. So although I find it somewhat difficult to have any admiration for a lot of individuals or the Republican Party, I do find Dick Nixon to be near and dear to me simply because he saved me from having to go to the war. So it's kind of interesting how that all happened. I was, like many folks, fearful of the possibilities of that happening. Again, that war, like the war today, we find that it was just a tragedy and lost a lot of people in that war for reasons we still don't at this point understand, or I don't know if we'll ever understand, but I was just blessed in the regard that I didn't have to go to that and be a part of that. So that's the history as far as my military experience is concerned.
Derek, can you tell me, what did your parents do?
My dad was, as I mentioned earlier, an employee here at Fisher Body. My mom started out as a domestic, working, cleaning homes around the city. She also did some nurse's aide work and then finally became employed over at the Oldsmobile facility on the chassis side. And so she retired. Raised five kids. I'm the oldest of five. It's pretty much work and... my parents are very, I recall them fondly. My dad worked hard, played hard, and was hard on us as kids. You know, my mom was probably the strength of it all. I mean, she held the household together and was a big influence on all of us in our rearing here in the city. Again, like I said, four boys and a girl. I'm the oldest of four, the girl being the youngest. All doing well, families, homes, jobs. My parents played a major role in our development and what I am and what they are today as far as their involvement in the community and outlook on life and as a whole.
All right. Well, before we get into your work history, we want to talk a little bit about what you knew about the plant before you came. You said that your father worked at Fisher Body. Now, did you live near the facility at all?
Actually, we grew up right here, like I said, in the city on the west side. lived on Lenaway Street, which is less than six blocks away from here. I can recall as a kid coming up, it was interesting. My dad worked nights along with, there was a group of folks in the neighborhood, O.J. Richardson, Cecil Bethany, Al Bethany, and those guys used to, what happens, they would all carpool to work. And they would start at O.J.'s house, and they would kind of like drive down, you know, drive down Lenaway Street, and they'd just pick them up as they would go along the way there. They would all just gather together and come on over to fish your body. So I do recall how that all happened, and it was almost routinely every day. And I can remember, of course, my dad worked two jobs at the time, so we'd go to school, we'd come back home, and he would just be getting up and getting ready to go to work. So it was always a point in time where it's you'd always be like at the last minute trying to get things done and get ready to go to work. I mentioned earlier my mom was a domestic, so she would be at work and they never saw each other throughout the week because she was at work and he was on his way going to work. So at a certain point in time, I became the cook, bottle washer, babysitter, the whole nine yards, looking after my siblings and also kind of preparing meals, if you will, for my dad. So that's kind of how I got into the domestic side of it, if you will, in terms of my ability to, you know, kind of take care of myself and prepare meals now, a lot like I do at home for my wife even today. So,
Derek,
yeah.
Can you tell me, what did you know about your father's work?
I knew that he worked in the body shop. I knew that he was busy. I mean, he worked all the time. I mean, he just seemed like that's all my old man did, was worked, and like I said, he worked hard, he played hard. When he wasn't working, he, you know, liked to socialize with his friends and partake in, you know, the alcoholic beverages and things of that nature. But he worked in the body shop. He was a utility person. He worked in the siding department. He worked just a number of different jobs throughout the facility there, and was very popular, I guess. You know, a lot of guys knew him, and he knew a lot of folks in the facility. And he also tells a lot of fond and humorous stories about his experiences here in the facility and such. So.
As a child, did you ever get a chance to come into the facility or near the facility?
I remember they used to have plant visits, and when they would have, like, different model, what do we call those now? Not changeovers, but when they were, I remember one time in particular when they would have a family outing, a family night or something that would allow folks to come to the facilities and take the tours of the plant, and I remember some of the concept vehicles back in, like, the 60s that we thought were just, like, space-age kind of stuff that were going on there. I like the Tornados, the 70 Tornados and stuff like that, those vehicles. Man, it was this unbelievable, the designs and all of the features and so forth that those cars had and whatever. And we were just, you know, so awed at what was going to be or what the possibilities were in terms of those kind of things. So I do remember those. I also remember like in the front on Valendon Avenue there, how the windows used to be open up and stuff, and we would, you know, come by there throughout the night. You know, my mom used to take us to the old Tasty Freeze right over here off of Saginaw Street. We'd come by at night and look there, and you'd see people standing on the outside looking at those windows and could be talking to folks. I guess that's what they were doing. I don't know what was going on there, but yeah, I remember those times. There's something else I want to talk about, too, as far as my childhood. I used to play Sandlot baseball, and we used to play a lot of our games over at Westside Park. And during the days or the mornings during the summer, when we were out of school and whatever, we used to have to ride our bikes or walk to Westside Park or whatever. I can remember the walk from Michigan Avenue to the end of Fisher Body being the longest walk there was. I mean, when I got past there, I was home free then. I knew either way, coming or going, when I walked past that, I mean, it just seemed to be such a mammoth facility. I mean, the size of it and this, yeah, that was something that was pretty interesting. I'd go walk there, or like I said, ride my bike. I'd have my baseball cleats, my baseball glove, my baseball uniform, and it was it was always something that was pretty special walking by there, because I was always so curious about what was inside of there, you know, and if I'd ever end up there.
Did you ever have any interaction with any of the other employees outside of your father and the other neighborhood gentlemen?
Well, my my uncle, Wade Latham, used to work there. He spent a lot of time there. Sam Haney was another one. I mean, a lot of the folks, Jay Pfeiffer, Elmer Pfeiffer. There was, I mean, everybody in the neighborhood. I mean, if you had, I shouldn't say everyone, but the majority of the folks that lived in the neighborhood also worked at Fisher Body or had some sort of ties with the Fisher Body. Also building one of those facilities there.
So, what did the neighborhood think of Fisher Body having? What was it like to have a factory as a neighbor? From your high school and in your neighborhood, did it affect your environment?
You know, it's funny how that all came into play. As a youth, we didn't really pay much attention to it at the time. But over the years, you talk about the sounds of the city or the environment in itself. Fisher Body, Oldsmobile, the Drop Forge plants, all of those kind of things. There were sounds that were just products of the work places around here that had some significance there. I remember in my latter years, and even when I started working here at Fisher Body, how folks were complaining about the stench that was coming out of the stacks and so on and so forth. As a kid, it was just a part of that whole environment. Of course, there were no environmental regulations and things of that nature, but I can remember many a day going outside and cars would just be covered with, you know, sediment from the stacks and emissions and so forth coming out of those facilities. It was just a part of the environment. That's what we did, and nobody really had any complaints or made any noises or anything about that. I can remember nights when, like, the hammering and the pounding from the Drop Forge facilities and so forth, that used to put me to sleep. That was my lullaby at night in a lot of cases, you know, and it's just the way it was. The vehicles, long before they expanded Martin Luther King, now Martin Luther King, when it was Logan Street, I mean, it was just, what, four lanes all compressed right there together in the neighborhood. That was just a product of the neighborhood. I mean, the trucks going up and down and the sounds that made throughout the night continuously because it was constantly running all the time. Olds Avenue, I mean, it was just a constant merry-go-round, if you will, of trucks and vehicles passing down through there. Parking lots used to be just full of cars all over the place down through there, and it was just it was life. That was the way it was. I remember when I went to Sexton High School. I spent a year over at Sexton, and we used to practice out there in the field, and you could see the big green. We call it the big green monster over there, and be out there playing and practicing or whatever we were doing out there, and you know, the emissions that were coming out of there and the sounds and what have you, that was just all a part of the community. It was just all a part of our history. That was our livelihood. That was our folks' livelihood. That's what provided us, you know, the quality of life that we had, which was, for me, I wouldn't trade any of it. I wouldn't trade none of it at all.
Now, as a child, when you were over at Sexton playing on the field, did you ever notice any of the workers on the roofs watching you?
Yeah, at night, you know, they used to do that, particularly, you know, game nights or whatever. I can, you know, folks would be up on the roof, and my dad in some cases would be up there on those roofs looking out too. That was their way of being able to attend, but not physically, because of course they had obligations at work or what have you. But yeah, they would be up there, and you would, you know, he'd come home and, you know, give us critique our games and whatever. So, yeah, it was pretty cool to see that up there. I noticed that.
What about the trains? GM had, we had trains coming in out of the facilities. Was that part of your use?
Yeah, that too. All of that, the train. No, I never played on them. I didn't mess around with that. And of course, they were pretty strict, too, in terms of, you know, well, my parents told you to do or not to do. You adhered to it. I mean, there wasn't no questioning or no judging it or... I mean, I probably stretched, you know, took some risk on some things, but for the most part, my folks, when they laid the law down, you adhered to it. There wasn't no, you know, questioning or judging it or anything else. And, of course, like a lot of times, too, in those days, I say those days like it's a long time ago. Well, it was a long time ago, but the entire community, I mean, everybody was a part of it. It didn't matter. And And your folks, the people that my folks knew, and with that adage, it takes a village to raise a child. I mean, that was in fact the truth. I mean, everybody, it didn't matter, black, white, whoever it was, your teachers, your neighbors, folks in the community, if they saw you, you know, getting out of line or stepping out of line for whatever the reason was, 9 times out of 10, it was going to get back to your parents, you know. And I was always fearful of those kind of things because the consequences in a lot of cases weren't very pleasant, you know. But,
Derek, across from Fisher Body, there's a place called Harry's. Did you ever go to any of the neighborhood establishments around there as a child?
As a child, No, I didn't. In fact, I didn't know much about Harry's until actually I hired into the facility there and started going, you know, for lunch and cash and checks and things of that nature. For the most part, we had our boundaries, again, that we could, you know, hang out in or, you know, travel within and what have you. And, for us, you know, St. Joe's, Sexton High School, you know, as youth I'm talking about now, Michigan Avenue to the north, and probably Main Street to the south, and you know, that was pretty much geographically where we hung out at, and that was our village, so to speak, if you will.
Okay, I was going to ask you. So now, you went in there and your father came in, your father worked here. What brought you into Fisher Body? Did you think that as a child over at Sexton that you would be working in the Fisher Body?
No, as a matter of fact, it's interesting you ask that because my dad was always one who put a lot of emphasis on education and making sure you don't want to have to come in there, son. You don't want to do that kind of thing, you know, and whatever you can do. You know, to better yourself, you know, I'd like to see you do those kind of things. And of course, there were a series of incidents that occurred that, for me, it just worked out to be that way. The timing of it all and the economy I at 17, I was a parent. I became a parent, okay? There were a lot of things that changed in my life as it relates to those kind of things. After the situation happened, again, I talk about my parents and their strong influence and what have you. My mother was just like hell-bent on making sure that I was going to own up to my responsibilities as a man and do the things that were expected of me. And above all, I was going to be responsible for my actions, raising a child and taking responsibility for that. And more so than anything else, making sure that the young lady who was the mother of my child, I was not going to abandon and make sure that I took care of those kind of things. So after that happened, my parents and my now in-laws were very instrumental, too, in us being able to continue our education, move forward, and do the things that we had to do. And so I was, you know, immediately, all of the extracurricular activities I had, all the fun then as a single young man without any responsibilities all changed for me. You know, I had responsibilities, and I had to go to work. I had to provide. I had to do what was necessary now as a parent because I have parent responsibilities now. So my dad, you know, I said he always insisted that I not or tried, if at all possible, to avoid going into General Motors. Got a job at New York Carpet World when I was 18, 19 years old. I started working at New York Carpet World there. I started as a stock person. I used to, you know, cut remnants, cut carpet, roll remnants, and things of that nature. And ironically enough, Doug Rademacher and I, that's where we first ran into each other. We were in Carpet World. We were both young kids, teenagers at the time, or whatever. Doug was there. And initially, I started out in, like I said, stock room and in deliveries and cutting carpet and things of that nature. And eventually, I advanced or moved up to sales. And in sales at in those days, in the late 70s or whatever, it was okay. But starting out, particularly in retail, there were times when, you know, depending on the business environment, the economy and things, You know, there were weeks where, you know, if business was going well, I could eat prime rib, you know. But if the business wasn't going well and sales were down, I was eating potted meat and peanut butter, you know. And so, and at the time, if I recall, I didn't have, there were no health care benefits, things of that nature that were there. And again, I had responsibilities. I had a family, or I wanted something a little bit more secure for me, something a little bit more consistent as far as incomes and so forth, so that I could provide for my family. And it was at that point in time when I looked at my old man, had a conversation with him, and it came to be. I mean, General Motors was hiring, and I can remember those. That time in 1978, I want to say it was like April, May of 1978, and they again were having this big exodus of folks that they were hiring or taking in. And I recall getting in a line on, I don't know what day it was, but there was a line from the Verlinden entrance of Fisher Body all the way down Verlinden Avenue towards Michigan Avenue and around the corner. People were lined up, just wanting to get into that place, you know. And of course, the one thing my dad, I do recall him saying after we had the conversation about me going there, was the pay was consistent, benefits were available to you, and if you went, you know, and you did what you were supposed to do, you were going to find it would be a lot more better for you economically, and also for a way of being able to provide a means of providing for your family. So that's what I did, and lo and behold, I got in there. I will say that I think that back in those days, too, a lot of whether or not you were considered for employment there also had a lot to do with your experiences or relationships with folk in the facilities. For example, my dad. A lot of doors have probably been opened for me as far as my involvement, as far as my employment at General Motors, my employment at, or my activity and my involvement in the labor unions, things of that nature. I give a lot of credit to him for at least allowing me access to, because of the folks that he knew and the folks what folks thought of him during that time. And of course, it was up to me once I got in the door to carry my own weight or my own load, if you will. But it was certainly a credit to him, I think, and folks that are relationships that he formed that was able to open some doorways for me.
So it's 1978.
78, yep.
You've gotten hired in.
Mm-hmm.
What department were you hired in?
I was hired in the body shop.
In the body shop.
Oh, that person.
Now, your father had hired in the body shop.
Yes.
What was your first job like? And tell me, was it what you had expected? Was it what your dad had told you? Were you surprised by anything?
I was surprised by it all. In fact, I walked in, and it's funny. In 78 in the body shop, they still had it before they used to transfer the jobs from one site to the other. And I had this job where I drove a finger truck, where they would transfer the bodies from one line to another, and they put them on the hoist, and then they my first job in hiring in Fisher Body was a line feeder. The bodies would go through the process, the build process in the body shop, and as they got to the end of the line in the process in the body shop, myself and my partner were on what we call finger trucks, and it was a vehicle that you stood up on. And you had to steer it, and it had a clamp or a grip on the side of it to where you would pull up at the end of the line, connect with the carrier of the vehicle and transfer it to a hoist where they would then take them and put them on what we now know as the carriers that go through the rest of the process. And they would take them, and the next step in the build process would be to go to the paint shop. And I did that for my first 89 days, I guess it was, that I was in there. It was kind of interesting to do that at first because, I mean, to hire in right off the street, I know a lot of folks that I hired in with, they were down there in the jungle and all those kind of jobs where they were the least desirable, if you will. And in those days, the body shop was probably just horrific in terms of the work environment or whatever. It was dark, it was dank, it was smoke-filled. It was, if I envisioned it, and I used to think when I was, of course, 20, 22 years old, all day long we would be down there, and I would always think, God, I'm sure glad I don't have to work in those areas down there.
Gary, what's the jungle?
The jungle is the body shop. Actually, it was, if you can envision, and my dad used to always talk about this too, how in the body shop there was the weld guns and things of that nature, and there was just a lot of cables, and like I said, it was dark, it was dank, and they referred to it as the jungle because all the cables, and it looks like vines in a forest or in a jungle where trees and limbs and stuff were just all over the place. There was really no structure or anything. They walked in there, and if there was a job or an operation that they wanted to set up, they would just put it in there. There were no considerations or anything. They just made it all happen,
Derek, you were lucky enough to hire it in to what was considered a preferred job.
Yeah.
Do you feel that your father had anything to do with that, or some people knowing your father had anything to do with that, or were you just a good luck of the corn?
I want to say it was probably a little bit of both of those. I think, again, of course, in those days, they just walk in there and they grab you. If you were, it didn't necessarily matter about your skill level or whatever. If they needed guys, 6 foot tall, 200 pounds or whatever to do a specific task, they just grabbed you. It didn't matter.
Grab you from where?
From the pool of new employees that came into the place there.
How large was your pool? Do you remember how many people you hired in there?
I'm going to guess probably when I first came in, there was probably maybe 10, 15 of us all that came in. And again, they just went down the line. Now, fate, law of averages, luck of the draw, my old man knowing who was in there was probably a little bit of all those things that probably helped or benefited me or allowed me to be in that position at the time.
Do you remember any special talks or any special equipment that you were given to go and work down in the jungle?
Pair of safety gloves. Oh, in the jungle. Oh, my God.
That was a
dreaded day in the jungle because, of course, we had all been told that eventually they were going to make the change to where the build process, where there was no longer the need for the transfer to have to feed these jobs from one station to the next. And of course, when that came into place, I was just depressed, because now what I had avoided for so long was inevitable, that that's where I was going, into the jungle. Of course, I went in there, and I'll never forget the first day I walked down through there, and those spot welders and things of that nature. I mean, it was, oh my God, it was a sad, sad day there when I had to leave that finger truck to go down there, because I remember guys that worked in the body shop in the jungle area there with those, working using those spot welders, they would come out in their clothing with just, like shirts and stuff would look like cheesecloth, because of the weld flash and so forth that was coming back on them and whatever, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. Of course, then when I went after being taken off of the, as a line feeder off the truck, I then got a job where I used to put the floor pans. I was at the very beginning of the process where the carriers would come down and we would put the floor pans on the carriers, and that would start the build process there. So it really wasn't that bad. I had my experiences with the spot welders, but after I hung up two or three guns and stopped the line from going down, they figured that probably wasn't something that I needed to be a part of. So they hurry up and got me out of there. And I was, believe me, it didn't disappoint me at all that they took me out of that.
When you hired in there as a new hire in both finger truck and or down in the jungle, were there any kind of new hire pranks or initiations that you had to go through down there?
Oh, yeah, there was of course, everybody there, the folks, and again, a lot of folks knew my dad, or, I knew folks in the that were from the neighborhood and so forth that were in there. And a lot of them were encouraging to me, and pranks. Of course, you know, there were always pranks and jokes and that kind of thing there. I can't really think of any one prank in particular that stood out, though, that that took place there. But it was just kind of interesting how, for me, you know, I would have a lot of conversations with some of the seniority folks that had been in the place there and whatever. And my whole thing was, I was never going to be there for any long period of time. I was just going to be there long enough to get me enough money to start my own business. Or I always wanted to aspire. I wanted to be what I thought then was some type of involvement with entertainment. I want to have a bar. I want to be in a cabaret or something like that. And my friends outside of the facility, we all shared that same dream. So we were all going to, you know, work and save our money and pool it all together and get us a bar. We were going to go into some sort of bar business or the restaurant business or something. Something to where I wasn't going to be building cars and working in this place forever and a day, you know. And, of course, all that changed over a period of time. And I can remember when I would share those stories with individuals that are already in there, they would just kind of look at me and laugh and kind of shake their head because apparently they all shared that same thought when they first went in there about how they were never didn't expect to be there for, you know, the work experience or the time that they were in there. So that was kind of interesting. I, of course, then, you know, after I hired in there and got married and I'd already had a child, I bought a house, then I bought a car. Then, you know, I remember the first home I bought, I bought a home for $12,000 in 1979. $200 a month, land contract, $200 a month was my payment on my home. Of course, then, you know, 22 years old, you got so many what you would consider priorities or things of importance to you at the point in time where, you know, of course, I could work, you know, the kind of money we're making those days, I could work 3 days a week, 4 days a week, and, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. I could still cover the expenses as far as my mortgage was concerned. My wife had a job, so it, you know, the attendance wasn't as much a priority at that time as it became later on when, of course, now I bought a car and I bought another car and I bought furniture and I bought all these things. So, you know, it's kind of funny how you evolve from, you know, what you consider you can blow off a day or whatever the point is. Now, you know, I want to be there 6 days. I want to be there 7 days a week. You know, so
the dream got further away, and reality became
more of the true story or true side of what it was all about.
Now, when you went from one job, they discontinued your finger job, or
yes.
You got.
Yeah, they were, as always, becoming more efficient in what it was and reducing the amount of manpower, I guess, if you will, from one to the other. You know, automation came into play, and they just, you know, engineers came in and designed a way in which they could eliminate that job and, you know, move on to something else.
Derek, in 1978, were there women in the body shop?
There were. Very few, but there were. And, you know, I talked earlier about how they used to just kind of like visually look at individuals and pick and choose who were, you know, going or who would be adapted doing specific jobs or whatever. And interestingly enough, a lot of the women were a lot larger in stature and so forth that had some of the jobs there. And, of course, being male-dominated in the body shop area there, too, you know, it's kind of interesting how the mannerisms and the conversations and just how they would interact and what have you today just wouldn't be tolerated in the workplace.
Can you explain that for us a little bit?
Well, just the engaging in conversation, what now would be considered, you know, violations, if you will, as far as harassment or sexual or, you know, harassment, those kind of things there. I mean, that was just common nature there. I mean, they cursed, they smoked, they chewed tobacco, they whatever the case was. There was just no...
what did you do for lunch and things like that?
throughout.
I mean, so what did you do for lunch, Derek?
At lunchtime, it's funny. You earlier you asked about Harry's. I remember when we would go out for lunchtime, and of course, my coworkers at the time, we would all leave, and you know, of course, you get that 32 minutes, 33 minutes for lunch or whatever, and it'd be just like this mad exodus, folks running outside to go and get the groove on, I guess, if you will, for whatever it was. And I remember when Harry's was nothing more than literally a hole in the wall. It was nothing like what it is today. I mean, they used to have single bulb lights hanging down from the wires and so forth in there, and you'd go there and fried bologna sandwiches and pickled eggs and beer. That was lunchtime kind of stuff, you know. You'd rush in there, and of course everybody would run in there, and it's funny how the routine that they had in terms of being able to provide you or serve everybody at you know, that short period of time that you had to get in and out of there, you know. And we'd go there, and depending on who had money, I mean, at the point in time throughout the week, you know, they would, you know, somebody would buy today, and if you had money tomorrow, it would be this kind of like this round robin thing, you know, in terms of who bought lunch or whatever the case may be. And we'd run out of there, and like I said, you get your little groove on and hurry up and run back in there so that when the line got ready to start up, you were all in place.
Derek, how did they serve you over here?
You kind of walk in there, and the waitresses, and of course Harry was out there too, you know, he knew everybody that was coming in out of place there, and you just tell them what you want. And there was no I used to be just kind of amazed at the memory that they would have. They'd holler out things in the, you know, throughout the place, and before you know it, your lunch was there and it was all set. Of course, booze was the beverage of choice at the time too, and it just kept it flowing the whole time, you know. And on Fridays, which was the day, of course, Fridays were payday and stuff, you know, and you would go in there, and I remember those, in fact, I still probably got a couple of those, the old checks now, that the cardboard, little card checks that they would have. And what used to always amaze me about Harry's, the Shop Stop, all of those little places right around there, is how you would go in there and they could cash, I don't care how many checks you had or how many folks wanted to cash their checks at that time, they would cash those checks and never miss a beat. You know, they always, I don't ever recall them not having money when you wanted to cash your checks. And they used to keep the change, you know, whatever the change was off the, that's what the fee was for cashing your checks at that time, you know. I was just amazed at how they could do that for, of course, the night shift, the day shift, and everybody else that would come in there. And the other thing that amazed me, too, is how this was just the respect, or I never heard of them being robbed or anything like that, but it was just pretty amazing sometimes. I just, even today, I mean, I guess they still do that, or, well, of course, they're no longer doing that, but right up until the time I left, you could go in there and they would always cash your checks.
Derek, given the fact that they were right by a plant, were lunches expensive, inexpensive? What would you say?
No more than any place else. I mean, if you walked in and you had the money, whatever it was you wanted, you got it. You know what I mean? So I can't really say to make a comparison as to, you know, one place or the other. I mean, you had, it was what it was. Either you went to Safeway or the store right here on Michigan Avenue, or you went to Harry's, Art's, or the Sharps, Shopstop. I said Art's, Harry's, Gus's, I guess, or the Shop Stop to, you know, get your lunch or whatever, unless, you know, you brought it with you.
You were raised in Lansing. Mm-hmm. What was it like when you came into the plant and you start working with people from all these other communities? What was that like for you? What was the interaction like?
I don't want to put this. It was different. It was, you know, when you stop and think about folks that I would venture to say for the first time had ever even worked with people of color. and been around them or what have you. For the most part, I don't ever recall any altercation. Maybe one or two, but you know, you just take it for what they were worth and judge those people and just move on. It was those folks that you know you interacted with, because we all had one commonality, and that was providing a living and, you know, trying to survive and make it there and what have you. So it really, for me, I don't recall early on there being any tension as far as that goes. And if you sense that, there were some folks that were maybe reluctant, or you had to really work to engage in conversation or what have you. But overall, and I would think that a lot of that probably for me was a lot easier simply because of my experience in the retail business prior to that, where I worked with or engaged everybody. You know, I mean, it didn't matter who you were as far as I was concerned, black, white, red, or whatever, you were a commission and I was going to make it the you was. You know, so for me, it wasn't that way, although I do recall others that, you know, were constantly having conflicts, if you will, with coworkers or what have you, because of obviously cultural differences and things of that nature. But for me, for the most part, you know, and then as far as the supervisors, there were some that were there that were probably uncomfortable or were set in their ways, and because they were in a supervisory position, they could, you know, make life a little harder for you, I guess, if you will, or what have you. And you kind of knew who those individuals were. The person that comes to mind for me was Charlie Parmley. Y'all heard that name, I'm sure, in your interviews about it and whatever. Charlie was different. I mean, you know, but it was his way or no way. You had to conform with that, you know. And at the time, for me, it was... I used to have conversations with my dad about Charlie, you know. My dad and Charlie got along well, but they had obviously come up through the ranks together and developed some sort of a mutual respect, I guess, if you will, for one another, to where it was the way that it was. But for me, being the young whippersnapper coming in there with a flip attitude or whatever the case may be or whatever, and just, you know, just young, you know what I mean? We didn't necessarily see things eye to eye, and... Of course, I look at it now as a much older man, and being able to look at a lot broader perspective or whatever. He had a responsibility for what he had to do, and, you know, like I said, it was his way or the highway, you know, in a lot of cases. And of course, that dreaded day when my line feeder job ended, it was Charlie who took me down in the jungle. Also, Charlie was this big guy, you know, and he was real gruff, and, you know, he spoke, and, you know, it was no wavering one way or the other with him, you know. And I can remember that day, and he was walking in front of me, and I was walking head hung and just kind of shuffling along going there. And of course, you know, the sparks and the dark dank and the cables hanging all over the place or whatever. Man, oh man, that was a sad, sad day then when I went down through there. But I remember too how when I first hired in there, and of course, you know, like a lot like now, you know, when they would give you the line time, you would go in there, and of course, you start out at 6:18, I think is the time that we started back in the 70s or whatever, and you'd go in there and you'd work, and of course, I got other priorities now. I just want to hurry up, get in here, get my little time on, and get back outside so I go hang with the fellas and go play basketball or go do whatever I wanted to do at that time, you know, and you know, you go in there thinking 8 hours, and before you know it, sometimes you'd be there 9 hours, sometimes you'd be there 10 hours or whatever, you know, and you just see, like in the body shop, we used to see them cars, just those jobs just rolling down through there. And it was just, like I said, gray pieces of metal just rolling down through there. And I used to ask myself, who in the hell is buying all these cars, you know, because it was just continuous, you know, and all you saw all day long were cars rolling down through there. And then, of course, you know, you've gotten together with your little coworkers and you want to hurry up and get outside so you can go and get what you would consider the priority at the time, whatever it was, hang in or going to do whatever. And 8 hours is what they come around and tell you. And, you know, the next 10, 15 minutes, and you're going 9 hours or whatever, you know. And I used to, I remember sometimes envisioning what hell must be like, you know, with the sparks flying around and dark and smoky and, you know, and it just, it was just one of those things, man. It was real experience. It was.
Were you on second shift or first shift?
I worked first shift, and you know, surprise, that's another thing too. Hired in on the day shift, and I would think probably out of the 23 years that I was in the plant, I probably worked a total of maybe 2 years on the night shift. Total. I was fortunate. I was lucky for that reason. I don't know how or what. I mean, it all just kind of worked in there. This all kind of like fell into place for me. But yeah, I didn't spend much time on nights at all. Of course, again, you know, I talk about the priorities and so forth and things of that nature. When I first hired in there, wasn't long after that, I had this DJ service, okay? And I would play, you know, during the day, I would work, and at nights, I would DJ. So I was like, you know, all the different little nightclubs and night spots around here, whatever. I'd always had, that was like my second job or whatever, if you will, and my little hustle on the end. So it just always worked out to where I was fortunate enough to be able to do that.
Derek, did you always work in the body shop?
No.
How long did you work in the body shop?
Worked in the body shop from 78 to probably about 81, I guess it was. At that point in time, I had an injury and got injured in the body shop and had to have knee surgery. And I was out for probably, I guess, maybe 6-8 months. And when I hired back in there, or when I came back, returned back to work, of course, you had to go through the medical to get clearance and what have you. And there was a woman that worked in personnel, her name, Donna. I can't remember what her last name was. Little short, petite black woman who worked in personnel, and for whatever reason, I had to go and see her. And it was at the time that she and I got to talking, and I, you know, she would come down in the nights and those Friday nights when I was playing in the clubs or whatever. Her and Chuck Reynolds and a few other folks, and I got to know them and whatever, and had a little conversation with her. And next thing I know, I ended up in the paint shop. I always thought I wanted to go to Trim.
So it was who you knew, huh?
Well, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your injury? How did you get injured?
I was in the coming out of work, and it was in the winter of, I'm going to say, like December, and you'd have to come up those stairs coming out of the plant of Linden Avenue, the main stairway right there, and came out of there, and I was icy on the stairwell and whatever. Of course, I'm, you know, running up the steps and whatever, slipped and fell and just hit my knee right on the rung. The stairwell, the steps right there, just tore it up. It was horrible. I mean, of course, a big guy like I am too, and I hit my knee, and all the force that came down on it just really messed up my kneecap, separated and tore all that up and everything. And so, yeah.
You called yourself a big guy. How big?
6'2", probably at the time, 185, 190. That's a good size. Like, smaller than what I am now.
Given the fact that
those were the days.
Given the fact that you hurt yourself on the stairs going into the plant, was that considered workers' comp or sick leave or?
Comp, and you know they didn't necessarily. For me, it was never really challenged at that point in time. I guess you know they, you know, I just went through the process, and of course I had to have knee surgery at the time, and during those days, it was never really challenged or questioned, although, you know, of course, I was aligned with some good physicians, too, that always made sure that they took the time and would go the extra mile, if you will, to make sure that you were covered and you had, you know, the coverage of your physicians and whatever, and it was never really challenged.
You've gone out, you've been injured, you come back in.
Donna, I wish I knew who Donna's name. Donna, I can tell you what Donna's name was, but I don't remember it. But had a conversation with her, and again, like I said, I thought I always wanted to go to Trim. lo and behold, after once I got in there, I realized and got to moving around a little bit more. I'm so glad I didn't go to treatment. I don't know what to do.
Day shift, night shift, and paint.
Day shift. I had day shift in paint, hired in and paint, or went back to paint, and went in the sealer line. I worked in, on the sealer line. Jay Johnson, Willie Thompson, Nate Hall, all those guys were Joy Clink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Joy Clink. Those are some folks that, that come to mind in terms of people that I worked for in those areas. Worked on the sealer line there with Leo Shane and Maxine Johnson. And
can you tell us what the sealer line is?
Sealer line is where they had, again, the I guess that was a cleaner version of the jungle where, again, you saw all of these cables and hoses and stuff hanging down, and they used to have wands, I guess, that you would use to apply a sealer along the seams and crevices of the jobs throughout the body to for a number of reasons, to seal leaks on them, to keep them from any wind noise and things of that nature that were probably considered product inefficiencies or whatever. The sealer line was the process, and again, there were, you know, on both sides of that process right there, there were folks that would just lined up all the way through there, and we would apply the sealer on different parts of that. And the first job that I had was the I was applying sealer in like the trunk compartments and what have you, and the different seams all the way around that process.
Derek, how did the paint culture, the paint shop culture, differ from the body shop culture?
It's a lot cleaner, a lot more diverse in terms of women and men working both in there. A lot brighter, although, yeah, it was just a completely different process overall. I mean, folks were. I want to necessarily say any more friendlier, but you certainly had the ability to engage and see a lot more folks, unlike it was in the body shop, where, of course, with those well guns and things of that nature, that was your main partner all the time was that gun, because the jobs, those were just coming continuously down through there. So,
Derek, you said that there were women in the body shop who were harassed. What would be considered harassment and stuff like that? How did the interaction in the paint shop between men and women? Was the same type of behavior going on? Had things gotten better for women?
The mentality was starting to change at that time, I think. Although I talked about women in the body shop initially. You know, just whatever interactions that guys did, I guess you didn't there were some limits, but as far as like the cat calls or goosing people, what we call goosing people, where you would, you know, what would now be considered inappropriate touching and things of that nature there, where it was all fair game in the body shop as far as that goes. Of course, when you came up to paint, you were allowed to be a little bit more I don't want to say casual, but your dress was a lot more, it changed. You didn't necessarily have to wear the coveralls all the time and things of that nature. You could wear your regular, you know, street clothes or whatever. What would you consider appropriate for working, what have you? But the attire, the look, the atmosphere was a lot more open, I guess, if you will. A lot more, you can engage folks a lot better. And aesthetically, it was just a lot... it was a much more pleasant environment as opposed to the body shop.
Doug Rademacher. Derek, you worked in the body. You said something about being a DJ and spinning records. Did music become a part of the environment in your workplace?
Oh, yeah. It was very much a part of that. Sometimes that was all. I mean, in fact, I still have the first... what now they call boom boxes that I hired into that plant with. And I remember the day I went to Sears and purchased this box that was my, it had a dual cassette deck in it and, you know, big, you know, and I would, you know, that was, for me, that was like the, my companion, that was my, I used to call it my sanity box, you know what I mean, in order to be able to keep me, like the music and the sounds and stuff like that. That was my way of being able to make it through the day. I would bring my music, or I would listen to the radio and whatever, and songs and things like that that would help me. I still got that radio. I still got it. It still plays. It still works. And that was back in, I'm going to say, 81 when I bought that thing. Yep.
Well, there was a time. Did you ever have what they called radio wars? Did you ever have to go through that where a coworker had their music and didn't like your choice of music? Did you go through that?
Well, yeah, there were times, but you know, again, we just always seemed to work it out. I would be considered, I guess, if you will. I wouldn't play those kind of games. That was kind of trivial as far as I was concerned. I would just keep it to whatever was comfortable at my workstation, because, you know, it was always, I worked in, like I said, in the along the sealer line there, and I had this job where you used to do the permagum. We used to apply permagum on, like, the doorways and things of that nature there, and, of course, it was always constantly having to go back to your workstation, so I just kept it to whatever was comfortable at that time and not bothering other folks.
Derek, you did the sealer jobs and things like that, but how did working in the paint department differ from working in the body shop? What types of things did you know were the biggest differences for you?
The of course, the jobs were a lot different there. And in the paint department, there was a lot more emphasis on, again, I talked about working on the sealer line, making sure that applications of, for example, sealer, or and the one other job that I had, the permagum jobs, where covering the seams or making sure that the priorities as far as the build process were a lot more different there. In the body shop, it was all about welds and putting it all together. As you moved up in the process or along the build process, starting to put finishes, I guess, if you will, and smoothing off the rough edges and things of that nature, that was all a part of what the paint process was, particularly in the early stages of that, the sealer line, and of course sanding the jobs down or whatever, smoothing them, all getting them ready for the next phase, which was actually applying the paint and whatever. In the paint department, there were a couple of things. I talk about, you know, of course, the environment being a lot better, a lot brighter up there, a lot more diverse as far as, you know, men, women are concerned. Some of the things that were different, though, is like in the paint department, you're working with a lot more chemicals in the air, things of that nature. A lot of the sealers, a lot more of the cleaning products and so forth that you had to apply to the jobs and whatever. Were just a part of the process. The smell was a lot different. I can remember, depending on what part of or what areas you worked with in the paint department, how the paint, you know, on the floor and stuff, how sticky it was in there, and having to walk through paint all the time. And of course, you became a lot more conscious too of the shoes you wore outside the plant as opposed to inside the plant, because, you know, all you take is one time to walk around in your car or something, and you track that paint outside from into your car or at home in your house or something like that. It was just real bad as that goes. But the other thing, too, is as far as the difference in the paint department was the jobs. There were a lot more finesse involved in the processes. And I can remember how I used to struggle initially when I would get broken on a job, trying to keep up with the job and being concerned about making sure that I had it done right, because not only did you have to apply, be it a sealer or the permagum right, there were certain specifications and ways that they wanted it all done. And, of course, you got, you know, your inspectors down at the other end who were looking at it a fine-tooth comb, and, you know, they were critiquing you and all the time, hollering and screaming about not getting this done right and that. And, of course, you had the water test, too, that you had to go through and making sure that, you know, your operation wasn't one where, you know, water problems or leaks in the jobs and so forth, all those kind of things. So it was an ongoing process. And one day, you know, I mean, you could be on your game one day to where, you know, you wouldn't have a problem, and then the next day you might have multiple water leaks, or whatever the case is. And so much of that process, as far as the assembly process is concerned, is so much dependent upon folks in the process, be it before you or after you, in terms of how successful or how efficient you're going to be at your job. Be it like in the body shop, if there was a weld or something that was out of place or whatever, that could certainly alter, you know, the outcome of what your process was going to be there and how you were judged or how efficient you were or how did you how good you were able to do your job. So it was just, and that's something that we all began to learn later on in the process too, when quality and productivity became so much more of the forefront in terms of the emphasis. I mean, it was always an emphasis, if you will, but the later as you went through the process, I just seemed to think that they put a lot more emphasis on it at that time.
Derek, you said that you had radios in the paint shop.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have radios in the body shop also?
I don't recall it being a whole lot of radio. Maybe in some operations, but for the most part, it was just so noisy down in the body shop and so hectic and things to where, you know, it just, that wasn't, no, I don't recall. I never had one in the body shop anyway.
After being in the body shop and the paint shop, did you, well, you said you went out for lunch
mm-hmm.
in the body shop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you still able to go to body shop when... go out to lunch when you were in the paint shop?
Oh, yeah. You could, of course, you still only had 33 minutes to get it done, but I mean, it was like a sprint, you know, from the time that line stopped until you had to get back there. It was just so hustle and bustle, and everybody was doing the same, you know, just, well, I say everybody, not everybody, but a large number of folks would, if going out for lunch was a priority to get whatever you wanted to partake of as far as lunch is concerned, if that was a priority, you'd rush out there. And I can remember we'd rush out, and when I was in the pay department, Safeway, you'd go over there, and of course, whatever you wanted for lunch, you would rush over there to get it, and then sit in the cars with, you know, your coworkers or whatever, and we just all had it right down to a science, you know. And
can you tell me what Safeway was, please?
Safeway is the convenience store right across the street on the Michigan Avenue from the Michigan Avenue entrance, as a matter of fact, which is where we would go in and out of there at. We used to go over there, and I'll never forget, Miss Adato was the woman who owned that. And again, I knew her long before I went into the plant there. She was just like one of the neighborhood personalities, you know, that was in the area there. Ms. A knew everybody. She knew your parents. She knew your kids. I mean, she was there my whole life, you know, and just had that kind of relationship with her. Very friendly, very pleasant to work with, and you know, just that was just the way you go. And you go in there and get those Polar sausages, and of course, Ms. A sold lottery tickets, cigarettes, alcohol, booze, pop, whatever it was you wanted in there at the time. That's what you went in there and you did. So,
when you hired into the plant, were there many supervisors of color in the body shop and the paint department? Or more so in one than the other, do you remember?
More in the paint department. I'm trying to think if there were, if I knew of any supervisors of color in, I guess there was. There was, Fonnie Price was there, O.J. Richardson was there, Joe Shane, I think, was a supervisor down in the body shop. And the Nicholsons. Thess Nicholson and Earl Nicholson was there. And those were all individuals who, again, there was just like this bond or this relationship because they knew you, you knew them from the community, from the neighborhoods, relationships that they'd formed with my father and what have you. So, I mean, yeah, they knew, even though I didn't know them personally, they knew a lot about me. And that's how a lot of them things were getting back to my old man when I stepped out and lied about something because they knew your daddy, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Now, in paint department, it was...
In the paint department, it was all different environment up in the paint department. There was
Cleve Stepter.
Cleve Stepter was there. There was Nate Hall was there. There was Jay Johnson that was there. There was Willie Thompson was in the paint department. those names come to mind. And I say that only because Nate and Willie Thompson, those little couple characters when I first walked up in there, them were, they had come through the ranks and made it to like the supervisory level, and they just seemed to be a little bit harder, I guess, if you will, or tougher or more stringent. You know, just you had to play by the rules with them, you know. And of course, you found out later on as you went through that process that they were probably more played it on the edge as more than anybody else. But of course, when they achieved that role or that status of supervisors, you had to walk the line a lot tougher with them than others did, I think, you know. And it was just, I don't know, the egos, attitudes, whatever you want to call it, that made them act that way or whatever.
Derek, you seem to have a really nice personality. And you went out to lunch with friends. Were there any friendships that you made inside the plant that extended outside of the plant and still exist today?
Oh, tons of them. I mean, you know, we spend so much time in there together. You spend more time in at work, and that's the same way it is now than you do, you know, a lot of times with your own personal family members and what have you. And those relationships that you went through, the good times, the bad times, the ups and lows, the highs and lows, and personal experiences, because you know, when you had a specific job or operation in there, you developed a relationship with your partner, and hopefully a lot of times you enjoyed whoever it was that worked opposite you, because that was your workers, your friends. You just developed those kind of relationships with them. So you learn about their families, their history, their health experiences, whatever it was about those individuals, you can do that. And I would certainly say that a lot of those, even today. You know, another thing that really, really sticks out, though, for me is regardless to what your relationships were with individuals, it seemed like during, like the holiday periods and stuff like that, those times were really, really kind of special, too, in terms of, you know, we'd all get together, like, for Thanksgiving or Christmas or birthdays or something like that, and you would, folks would bring food in, and you'd have food, Christmas parties, and little gatherings in your little departments and whatever. Those were always kind of over and above, kind of special, you know, and like the, how attitudes would change, I guess, if you will, and folks became a lot closer together, and it didn't matter who or what, you know, it just didn't matter, you know, and people just came together a lot closer in those times, and I can remember those being pretty special. I remember in the body shop, for example, John Viegas was a guy out there. John Viegas used to sell tamales and breakfast dinners and breakfasts all the time, and every morning he'd come around, and he used to have his little route that he would make through there, and he would make breakfast sandwiches and what have you, and folks would buy those all the time, and he would always have a pocket full of money to loan you money and do different things like that. But you know, and I know John today, and it's one of those relationships that just kind of just evolved from that. And you know, everybody here in this room here, I mean, those relationships too. I mean, I remember. Just because, again, I talked about the times, the experiences, the things that we did over our work experience or whatever, that, you know, just a part of our life, a part of our history that, you know, you just never forget. And you form those relationships and those bonds, and it's always really special.
Derek, you said they were there in Vegas. Were there many implant vendors?
Yeah, there were tons of implant vendors, and the variety of wares that they were vending. Just
what types of things could you purchase inside the plant?
Just about anything you wanted and you thought you wanted was available to you at some point in time there. Things that you know, like I said, you know, food and I just leave that to the imagination.
Did you ever have any of the skill trades people do anything special for you? Inside the plant or out?
Inside the plant. You know, skilled trades guys, they pretty much, unless, you know, you had relationships with them or what have you, and you could maybe have someone in your workstation if there was something that you wanted to have done in particular that would be make it a little bit more comfortable or conducive for you to be able to work and what have you, those kind of things. If you had relationships or, you know, a tie with them, you know, you might ask them to do something along those lines. They talk about, I remember they talk about government jobs and things of that nature. They get somebody maybe to construct a locker for you or something, to, you know, those kind of things. It was always there, and it was important that they can make your life miserable, or they can make your life hell up in there if you wanted it. And I guess, you know, when I say make your work environment more conducive, I guess it would be what we equate to ergonomic conditions today and what have you, to make it more acceptable or more comfortable for you to be able to pull or to do a specific task. You know, a lot of times the hoists and balancers on jobs or whatever can make a difference as to how you felt at the end of the day when you went home. If you had to fight against a particular piece of equipment all the time, that would certainly be a lot more taxing on you physically than if you had a situation where they would, you know, balance it or make it to where it was a lot more easier for you to handle it, you know, in different situations. So yeah, the skilled trades guys were real important in those areas.
Doug Rademacher?
Derek, you said you had a family before you came in, so you grew up quickly as a young man. But I'd like you to share a little bit about the changes every 10 years. You grew up in the plant. Can you talk about how it changed? Like, I noticed a change in my own, and I worked with you. Every 10 years, did you notice a different, the way new people hired in? Just the change of attitude, the change of work ethic, some things like that.
Well, you know, when I hired in 78, after that, there was a long period of time before there was another hiring process. I say a long time. I'm probably going to say 80, the mid to late 80s again, before they actually brought some other folks in there. And it was change. Yeah, there was a change. In fact, my brother Carlos came in behind me, and he again had no idea what it was like to work in, you know, a manufacturing and assembly plant and what have you, and to just see the hard knocks, I guess, if you will, of what he had to go through, and having experienced those already, it was just kind of both comical and enlightening to see other folks have to go through that. Yeah.
Derek, can you tell me at this point what was probably one of the most funniest things you ever saw happen in the plant?
Funniest things I ever saw happen in the plant. God. I remember David Arrington, his name, they call him Woody. He and this guy, Joe McGee, worked up in there. And, you know, those kind of guys were always, they were the real pranksters, if you will, in the paint department. And just how they would engage with other individuals at points and times. And of course, they would, you know, fill your gloves with, you know, sealers sometimes or things of that nature. Those kind of pranks there, but just how, like, cultural differences, I kind of talked about those early on too, and how Woody he was just a character anyway. I mean, he can make you, you know, you just go the whole gamut of emotion with Woody, but he was just real, real comical in his mannerisms and his daily activities and what have you. He just comes to mind in particular. I can't think of any one incident per se that was really the most comical or something that really, really sticks out. It's just, every day was a new adventure when you walk through those turnstiles in there, and you just saw it all, you know, and a lot of things that others would may perceive to be comical or out of the ordinary. I mean, at some point in time, it was just a way of life up in there. You just went in there, you dealt with it, and came on back out of there, you know.
Do you have
a favorite moment?
Like I said, you know, probably more the times when, you know, around holiday periods and stuff, when everybody would kind of come together, because it'd be a whole different mindset. I mean, during those times, I mean, people just were a lot more conscientious about others' feelings, I guess, if you will. And it was just a whole time, the togetherness, and folks willing to just come together and share special moments and whatever, you know. And those times were pretty special.
I'm going to change gears a little bit, Derek. You said that your father was union active, and
yeah.
How did his union activity affect your work life? How did it inspire you, and did you do any union activities?
Yeah, my dad was involved in the union, and he was the civil rights chair, I think is what they called him before. It's now changed the title. Fair practice, and I can't remember exactly what the title was now, but it might have been Civil Rights and Fair Practices or something like that. But he was involved in that, and I can remember his friends and what have you, when he first got involved, how they used to heckle him and make fun of him, and, you know, call him a sellout or whatever for becoming involved in the union, and how, you know, he was kind of out of the ordinary, because then, you know, there was a lot of apathy there, and particularly for people of color, they just didn't feel included in the process and whatever. And you know, when my dad went there, he took a lot of I won't call it criticism, but they certainly heckled him and made fun and things of that nature. But it didn't make him any difference. He stayed there and continued to do whatever, and just kind of, you know, made his way through. It certainly was a time when, you know, he would share experiences, and some of the causes that were near and dear to him. I can remember, like, in the 70s, when the 30 and out was really significant as far as being able to retire and so forth. And I remember, too, how with automation changes and what have you, they used to... they were adamant about not wanting robots to come into the plants. You know, we don't want them robots in here. That was eliminating jobs, and that was, you know, putting folks out and things of that nature. And I mean, they struck for that for a long, long time. I don't remember exactly how long. I want to say like 10, 11 weeks or something like that. And I can remember that time when that was all going down. And I can remember actually going and having getting commodities and so forth to put food on the table, because they were out on strike at that time, you know. And of course, and my dad would come home, and he was very adamant about those things. Of course, when I went in there, after hearing some of the stories of some of the physical demands that the work put on them, you know, I was so damn glad they had robots. Some of those jobs, I mean, you know, let's face it, I mean, the 30 and out clause was put in there for a couple of reasons. I mean, if you spent 30 years in there scuffling and grabbing them damn, welding, spot welding guns or whatever, you fighting that, and not only those, the physical demands that put on you, but also at the time, now being a lot more conscious about, you know, work environments and occupational exposures and things like that, the environment, the air, and all those kind of things. If you live 5 years after you came out of there, you beat the odds as far as those things were concerned, you know. So, it was just a whole different environment for him, as opposed to me when I came in there with, you know, the addition of automation or the introduction of automation or whatever. The work was nowhere near as physically demanding as it was in those days. I remember him coming home and telling stories about how, you know, I had the luxury of I talked about the finger trucks moving bodies from one station to the other. He tells stories about where guys walking in there, and if, you know, you were 6 foot, 200, 210 pounds or whatever, you were going to be moving jobs all night long. You physically would take and push those cars from one station to the other in there or what have you. You know, you did that for 8-9 hours a day. I mean, come on, boy. That was work. That's what men were men. Of course, you know, another thing that I want to talk about, too, is, like, I remember hiring in there and how the older guard, if you will, when you came in there, I talk about in the CELA line for in particular, you know, they would provide at work, they'd give you gloves, they'd give you glasses, they'd give you things like that. Some of them older guys in there would, you know, like they were putting their hands and working with solvents and thinners and cleaners and stuff like that. They would never wear personal protection equipment. You know, I mean, that's where when men were men, you know, real men don't wear personal protection. You know, and, you know, and the work that I do today, which is, you know, occupational health and safety kind of things, I've become a lot more educated and a lot more aware of a lot of the shortcomings, I guess, if you will, that a lot of folks experience now as a result of not actually using personal protection equipment. A guy that comes to mind, and particularly for me, is Bo Green. I don't know, you guys probably... Bo Green worked in the paint department. I think when Bo retired, he probably had 50 years of it or whatever. But he worked in the paint department, in paint mixing. I imagine he'd done a multitude of jobs while there. But Bo Green would come in and he'd work in the thinners, the solvents. He worked in the paint booths. He was, you know, repairing the guns and all that kind of stuff. And he would walk in there and he would never wear any kind of respirators. He would never wear gloves. He'd wash his hands in them solvents and then just dry them and go back out and smoke a cigarette and chew tobacco. He did all those kind of things. Well, you know, unbeknownst to him, you know, he was ingesting a whole lot of that stuff, or those chemicals were absorbing into your bloodstream or whatever. And in his latter years before, you know, of course, he expired, a lot of that had to do with the lack of education or... being hard-headed, I guess, more than anything else, about not using that kind of stuff.
Derek, you use the term oleum. Can you tell us what that was, and was that used quite a bit throughout the plant?
Oleum was, more so in the paint department. It was one of the thinners, the solvents, the cleaners that they used to clean the surfaces on the jobs and whatever. And I guess it would be equivalent to anything else when you... Of course, in the days when, you know, you had to clean, and it was probably used for multiple uses, but it could clean anything, you know, as far as sealers, chemicals, paints, solvents on your hands and stuff. But we used to just use that. That was just one of the many, chemicals that we were exposed to in our work environments. And, you know, I don't think it was... up until like 1985 or after the 80s when they finally started actually educating you as to what it was that you were working with and some of the hazards that were associated with some of the stuff that you were working with. I mean, you think about it over an eight-hour period or 9 hours, however long you were working, and you multiply that by the number of days that you're working around these chemicals and what have you. They can have some really, really nasty effects on you physically, on your respiratory systems, and, you know, for women of childbearing age or whatever, and men for that matter, you know. I mean, just the outcome of some of those things and the exposures to those kind of those chemicals and what have you, it certainly had an impact on a lot of people as far as their health issues are concerned, even today, you know, and I don't know how many of them have been impacted by that, and I'd be curious to know, although I don't know how we would be able to record those kind of things, the effects on our children as well. Like, for example, in the body shop, in the old days when they used to apply the lead and solder to the joints and what have you, you know, now today, lead exposures are something that, I mean, they, you know, after the educational process or whatever, the physical impacts that can have on an individual, be it the ones that were there firsthand or, you know, being working around those chemicals all day long, and then unbeknown to us, we come out of the workplace and would take that stuff home and expose our family members to it, our kids, our spouses and what have you, or just folks in the community, mm-hmm. how those things would have an indirect but yet a direct impact on how our, you know, how our health issues and things would be.
Derek, I want to get back to you in a minute. You said, now, when did you first start getting involved with your local?
You know what? It was probably in the early 80s. I want to say 82, 81, 82. It's funny how this whole thing started. I was, again, working upstairs in the sewer line and dreading having to come in there every single day to do the work. I say dreaded. It was a way of providing me a living. So, you know, I knew I had to go. But at the same time, myself, I just kind of looked at it. There was a better way, you know. And I remember a group of folks coming around that, you know, were folks that I see working in the plant. But you started United Way campaigns, United Way drives. And these folks would come around and they would actually get off the line. They would work for an extended, designated period of time doing United Way campaigns. And they would come and get you off the line and go and, you know, solicit you for United Way contributions and things of that nature. And I got to look at it and I thought, I sure would like to get some free time. That's initially how it started out. I'll be honest, you know, as an escape from the leash, if you will, that you had as far as the end of that sealer line or that gun would go as far as your work or whatever, you know. And they come in there, they wore the nice clothes, and they would get out and get to intermix and engage others and throughout the plant or whatever. And Rudy Reyes was the guy, you know. For me, Rudy was the one. I just kind of, he was the chair, I think, of community services at the time, and he and I just kind of, I expressed an interest in wanting to do that, and he kind of picked me up and brought me on there, and it all started from there. I got involved in community services, and of course started going to union meetings a lot more and doing things of that nature, and it just evolved from there. I talk about this greenhouse. This greenhouse is, it's got a lot of memories in here. I mean, because this is where the Community Services Committee would meet a lot of times, and during United Way campaigns, this was our holding area, I guess, if you will, in between, you know, going out doing solicitations and what have you here. I remember doing selling old newsboys. I remember the gate collections. I remember all that kind of stuff, and where we would kind of congregate here and put our plan together as far as strategies and whatever, go out there and implement it. And I remember coming in here and myself and Dorothy Oliva and Art Luna and Rudy and you know, we used to count money in here from, you know, the gate donations and stuff that we used to do all right here.
Derek, when you did that union activity, were you excused from your line?
Yeah. We would, for whatever period of time that you were going to be gone, they would have utility folks or whoever the extra folks in the area were to cover your job and what have you for that period of time. A lot of folks used to resent that and used to get a whole lot of grief as a result of getting out of what they perceived or what they thought was getting out of work. They used to hold a lot of resentment about those kind of things. And
what about supervisors?
I never really, you know, I never really heard them vocally to me express, you know, any kind of, you know, feelings one way or another about it. But I'm sure that, you know, my coworkers held some resentment about those kind of things.
So when you would get off the line for a period of time to do a non-traditional assignment and then come back, was it hard to get back into the fold?
It's hard to get back in the fold because, one, once you got away from that lease, it was hard, always hard to come back and get back into the fold of that. But
what about in terms of people?
No, I mean, they may have had some ill feelings or resentments one way or the other, but, you know, I mean, you take that with a grain of salt because, you know, insults, if you will, or, you know, criticisms and stuff, that was as much a part of the work environment as anything else. So, you know, you took it for, you know, you considered the source and what you was coming from and whatever. I always held a position that my activity or my involvement was something that, you know, for those individuals who would have those criticisms and whatever, I would just, you know, in turn encourage them. You know, you had the same opportunities that I had to get involved and do these kind of things. So, you know, either you come on and let me show you what's going on or don't.
Stepping away from that for just a moment, in terms of employee involvement, non-traditional job assignments, employees getting taken away from the line to do other things, how instrumental do you think that was, getting that hourly involvement help in changing our product and making it great?
I think that had a significant impact. I talked about how, like in the mid-80s, how they started making folks more aware of occupational exposures and things of that nature. I remember early on, too, when they first implemented this quality work-life program, a QWL is what they used to call that, and I remember Bruce DeLand and Barry Class and Frank Stone and Cheryl, you might have been, were you, when did you come to this? Because I remember you being a part of my
I was in transitioning and training.
Yeah. I remember, you know, that part of that too. And quality work life was something that I think in the early stages of that really went a long way in terms of making folks at least aware of what the heck was going on as far as the our process as far as the work is concerned. And what a lot of what dictated that too was the start, if you will, in the mid-70s with the oil embargoes and things of that nature, and the imports starting to come into into the country, you know, because of the high gas prices and what have you. The imports were then perceived to be a lot more fuel efficient and things of that nature, as well as over a period of time they began to become a lot more, in a lot of folks' mind, a lot more quality, better quality and so forth than what we were providing here. And it's been, you know, through my history and my experience and, you know, different training programs and classes that I've attended that I understand now how that all evolved, too, in terms of the big three, if you will, in the 60s and the early 70s, just not really having any competition, so to speak, as far as the auto industry was concerned. So we were free to be and do whatever the hell we wanted to do. And, you know, we could build the big gas guns and big monsters and everything else, and we really never had no competition. But then with the influx of the imports that started coming in here, we had to become a lot more competitive now because we were starting to lose that gain, if you will, in terms of our freedom and ability to sell or put whatever product out there on the road and folks would buy it. You know, now we had to become a little bit more conscious of that. And the introduction of quality work life and all those kind of things, because now everybody had to understand what our position was and how the productivity and the quality of the vehicles now that we were putting out on the street was a lot more important to us all. That's why those programs were introduced.
In terms of your union activity, can you just give us a list of the different positions or positions that you've held in the past?
Community services was the first, and with that evolved into a lot of other things. Like I said, you know, Rudy Reyes, as far as my union involvement was concerned, he was probably the first person that I came in contact with and encouraged me to get involved in things. And him putting me on the community services committee course, of course, that required that, you know, you get a lot more involved and a lot more active. And, you know, for him, for me, I hold a lot of fond memories as far as that goes, as far as Rudy is concerned, because he was he was an activist. He cared about people, and in that community services chair position that he held, although he took a lot of criticism for a whole lot of things, one thing I could never criticize Rudy about was his willingness to go out and help others, you know, in whatever capacity. I remember the times when, he and I would be together during United Way campaigns or other activities or whatever, and, you know, people would come up and ask him to borrow money, and he would just, you know, if he had it on him, it wouldn't matter, you know. And I remember there was a time or two when he would look at me, you got $20, and I'd give him $20, and he'd turn around and give it to somebody else. You know, I'm thinking, what the hell are you giving my, you know, but that's just the kind of guy he was. If he had it and he could help somebody else, he would give it to him. And for those reasons, I got a lot of respect for Rudy in that regard, because the one thing about him was he would always give of himself and reach out to others and try to help them. Again, like I said, he took a lot of criticism for a lot of different things, but I've never known, and today still, if you're in need of something, he would he'd certainly be the guy from that. And from that, that evolved because of relationships that I've formed in local 602 to other things and kind of spread out. Community services, union label, Doug Rademacher and I, we've done a lot of things together in that capacity. He made me, really educated me about the necessity to get involved and advocate for selling union-made products and pushing American-made products and things of that nature. He's, you know, one of the guys that today and always has been. I mean, very, very much a part of those kind of things. But in those relationships, too, Marilyn, I mean, you and I on the Civil Rights Committee, things that we've done over the years and some of the programs, Black History programs and things, and how we would sit around a table and try to strategize and come up with ways of introducing various programs and putting some things together and stuff. That goes a long way. The Clue Committee. My first run at a elected position, I think it was Sergeant at Arms, after I finally got my confidence in there and thought I wanted to run for an elected position. I ran for Sergeant at Arms and was successful at that. Alvin Presley, once I got involved and started to attend union meetings on a more consistent basis, Alvin Presley was the one who introduced me to the A. Philip Randolph Institute. And, you know, a lot of times I wonder if it was only because I was just the only guy standing there and they really thought they needed to fill a specific position. Hey, you want to do A. Philip Randolph? Come here, you know. And, you know, that's how I got involved in that. Al Presley, he was another one that was probably real instrumental in terms of supporting and also encouraging, you know, participation and involvement as far as union activities go. I remember who was the guy that Alvin Presley's adversary there for a long time?
Terry Ward.
Terry Ward. I remember some of the confrontations that took place in those times and how, you know, even though, well, it was, I was going to say, even though they necessarily didn't want to come out and say it, it came right down to, like, racial lines and what have you in a lot of instances, too, in terms of who was going to lead, you know, Local 602 or whatever, you know, and those kind of things. And I remember Terry Ward and his followers or his contingency and how they would come in there and when Al was elected president, how they would just come in there and purposely try to disrupt and create havoc in union meetings and things of that nature. And they would come in there sometimes and, you know, specific issues or something that was going on. And I can remember so vividly how they would come in there, they would just load the union meetings up. You could always tell when there was an issue that was going on to where there was going to be something that required a vote. Because the Terry Ward contingency, when Alvin was in office, they would come in there and they just fill the hall up, you know, and they would come in there and whatever the issue was, they would, you know, act on it, and more often than not, they knew to load the hall up to make sure that they had the votes on their side. They would get whatever issue they want and then literally just walk right out of that, you know, and I mean, the way in which they done it, too, I mean, it was a laughing kind of ha-ha jokingly and, you know.
Did that ever affect the plant? The people on the planet are aware of that.
Probably. I'm sure that there were those, although they say, you know, we never had caucuses in our plant or in our local or whatever. Yeah, I'm sure that it did. I know that there was those divisions that were there, and they were there more so not necessarily because of one leader having his or her abilities or whatever. I would certainly say that, that race certainly played a significant role in those kind of things. But it was tough times, and you know, particularly for Al, I can only imagine what it was like being in a leadership role and also having to deal with that side of it as opposed to just the everyday operations and what all entailed in terms of holding that membership together over there at that time. It's interesting how when we first, as upstarts, when we come in there and you'd see folks in elected positions and different things and different chairs, and of course, the more you got involved and the more you got exposed to like your international reps and your regional directors and things of that nature, and how you'd always aspire to want to get in those positions and what have you. You know, they look glorious and they look glamorous until you actually sit in those seats to find out just how much responsibility there is in those positions and the amount of stress, too, because not only now is it you that you have to be accountable for, but the entire livelihood of your members, and then you multiply that by their family members and whatever. There's a ton of responsibility that the average person just doesn't have, particularly average rank and file individual who does not want to get involved or has no involvement whatsoever, and to make sure that they get a paycheck, and only when times or situations fall upon them to where they, you know, my health care or this situation or my benefits are affected in one way or the other. That's only at that point in time that they really become concerned.
Derek, can you tell me, what is it like, though, to be an active chair? Because chairmanships, like you said, you were the citizenship and legislative chair. Those chairpersons, they're not full-time. What is it like to be a chairperson per se, and run on the line? Like, for example, I know sometimes it's chairmanship and part of your union activity, you'd have to do a turnaround trip to Washington, D.C., and then to Washington, D.C., and then come back and go to work. Can you tell us, like, what that was like to wear the hat of a worker and a chairperson?
Complex, more so than anything else. I mean, you take into account just your regular everyday operations, and you got, you know, your family involvement that you got to be involved in, and then for those individuals who step up to the plate and want to take on more responsibility, if you will, it's just being able to try to put all those things together, because I mean, you're accountable for whatever it is, and you certainly want to do the best at whatever you are now deemed as the leader of a specific committee or whatever. You want to put your best foot forward and be able to do that, but a lot of that too depended upon the support that you had from the union to make available to you the resources as well as the time to be able to carry out your operation. And then a lot, too, had to do with the relationships that you had with supervisors, management, and what have you, in terms of them being willing, I guess, to be able to afford you to be able to carry out your activities. Because you, for example, in civil rights, I can recall having engaged you in, you know, different things or working on specific projects with you, and how you, you know, in between your breaks, which is a time where you're supposed to be able to sit down and get a little rest, if you will, from whatever you're doing throughout your, you know, regular operation throughout the day, you know, running and, you know, from the telephones or trying to go and meet with someone else and carry out different responsibilities, or making sure that you tied all of the loopholes or the open ends, I guess, together to make sure that this was all going to happen, was it's something, again, that only activists, you know, being in their right minds or not, would take on those responsibilities to do that kind of stuff.
Derek, you've held many hats. Currently now you are the, what's your title, please?
I am the Health and Safety Director for the Michigan State AFL-CIO.
So your job from a line worker, totally evolved. What are some of the other misconceptions that people who may not know any factory workers, What are some of the things about the workers themselves that people would be surprised to know about?
You know, because we've benefited so much from folks who've gone and fought the battles before us and achieved through, like, the collective bargaining process or whatever, the quality of life and what have you that we have, folks on the outside that have no clue whatsoever perceive us as being spoiled, perceive us as being overpaid, perceive us as being lazy, perceive us as being unappreciative of what it is that we have. Those folks really don't have a clue. And you know what, if you stop and look at them, a lot of it has to do with envy, for the most part, because of the things that we've been able to achieve. Not knowing the history, it's easy for folks to formulate those kind of opinions about what it is that, you know, we have, or the gains that we have and what have you. But
what about education levels?
That too, you know, again, because of the collective bargaining process, a lot of the folks that are out there that have education levels that exceed, far exceed what mine are, but yet when we step up to the plate and we, if you will, they measure your quality of life or your income levels and things of that nature, a lot of times they formulate opinions that I'm not deserving of, or that I got a free ride, I guess, if you will, or things of that nature. So, you know, nowadays, education levels are so much more in play with what we're able to do because of the changes in the manufacturing, or the changes in the skills and so forth that are necessary to acquire. In fact, just last week, I had a conversation with a guy who told me about when he hired in the 50s, how you can literally walk into Fisher Body and get a job. You can quit at the end of the week and go on the other side of town, and they would walk you right in there and give you a job. I mean, they were just that plentiful, and the work was that much more accessible to folks out there, and how, you know, those kind of things. But today, that's hardly the case. It's hardly the case.
Derek, you grew up just a few blocks from Fisher Body. You've been there and you've been through the name changes. Now, as we come to a close, Fisher Body, as we know it, is no more. The Big Green Monster is not going to be there the way we used to. How does that make you feel?
Like a significant part of my life, the community, the world is changing. I mean, it's you know, what I've grown to know and become a part of is a part of me that's going to be missed. The comfort that all of this provided and for me and everyone else is no longer going to be there, and the unknown is very, very much uncertain, as well as uncomfortable, I guess would be the best way to put that.
Is there anything that you'd like to share that we haven't touched on?
Just that, for me, having had the privilege of, one, getting hired in at General Motors, and I say that as a privilege because it's certainly that, because those were certainly, when we were kids coming up, although, like I talked about, my dad not wanting me to get involved or having me come there, he wanted me to become educated and move on to bigger and better things. Those jobs in the auto industry were certainly the more preferable jobs because of the monies, the quality of life, and the things that that provided, and the security that went along with that as well. The relationships that I've formulated through there, my involvement with the labor movement has certainly been one that has changed my life and the lives of many others, I hope, and I think has moved on even to my immediate family. My kids, having seen those kind of things and seeing how their involvement in trying to make a difference or change in others to better for others or what have you is certainly something that has been a plus for me, and just giving them something positive to look at has been a big change. My relationships, have certainly evolved from that. My community activism has certainly opened doors in the community that I know wouldn't have been there in a lot of cases, and I'm just appreciative of those things. Even today, at my position with the AFL-CIO, it's because of my commitment to wanting to help others and to make differences and what have you, and I'll be honest about it too. Some politics were involved in that, but politics is involved in any and everything that we do. Have certainly opened doors and done things. I've traveled places. I've been to, been involved in things that have just been life changing, and also expanded my horizons, my view on specific things, and it's all been good. I'm appreciative of all those things, and hopefully I've made some differences in other people's lives.
Well, Derek has also, being somewhat modest, he's also the state president of the A. Philip Randolph Institute. He is also has been a police commissioner. He's also sat on the board of United Way. Mm-hmm. He's been very active, and he is shown both his union and his company proud, and made me proud to be able to have this interview with you today, and I want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thanks. Derek, I can't let you get away yet. We said thank you, but what I want you to do is to make clarification there. You were UAW, and you are the Michigan State AFL-CIO Health and Safety Director. Does that mean you're not UAW anymore? And how did that happen?
Actually, I am, and always will be, first and foremost, UAW. Okay, that's how it all began. That's how I all got started in this involvement. The AFL-CIO is the umbrella organization, if you will, of all of labor unions throughout the country. Here at the state level, I held a position in the plant as the assessment coordinator for team leaders, orientation and assessments for folks that were evolving from then what we would call utility people or at the point in time to what they call now group leaders and such. And I held that position for about 8 months, I guess, with that the opportunity to interview and apply for a position. Tina Abbott, who's the Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO, noticed my involvement in different activities and what have you, and suggested that I put in an application to put in for the Health and Safety Director at the AFL-CIO. I applied for the position and was blessed enough to be able to get the job. Of course, I talk about your involvement and folks having to sign off, I guess, if you will, or whatever. It had to go through the entire UAW hierarchy, whether or not, one, I would be considered, and I'm sure that they look at that time, your commitment, your involvement, your worth, I guess, if you will, in being able to further causes, and whether or not you'd be deserving of holding or being able to deserving of involvement or participation as far as those things are concerned. And with that, they, along with an agreement through General Motors, agreed to extend you what we call union leaves. And now with that, although I am now with the AFL-CIO, union leave was granted to me to allow me to continue to do those things and still be able to hold my membership or my allegiance to the UAW and Local 602 as a dues-paying member. And I now lead the UAW, or I now represent UAW Local 602, but I also work as a member of organized labor for the AFL-CIO.
So you continue with your seniority, correct?
Yes. My seniority will accrue the same as if I were actively working here at Local 602 in the new Delta facility as a result of that.
Just to finish up on that, then, I would like to, Doug Rademacher. Derek, since the people that are going to listen to this and do papers on and studies for their papers for college, what would you tell a person about the auto industry and the importance of getting involved in politics and your local community activities?
I think that that is paramount, not only in the auto industry, just whatever involvement or how society impacts you, wherever you fall in the mix of your society or your income levels, your education levels, and things like that, or just personal beliefs, things that you believe in. I think that involvement is it's a must if you want to make or impact change in terms of what's going on or what happens around you, not only you as an individual, but your family, your kids, your parents. I mean, whatever it is, if you can either be a part of a change or you can sit back and let change impact you without having any say about what goes on around you, and if you do that, then I guess you have to accept whatever happens to you.
Derek, and as we come to a close yet, so again, I want to say that, number one, you know, I think you're an awesome father since your son is going to school to become a doctor and pulling great grades.
At the MSU, by the way.
At the MSU. You have been a stellar member of the community. You have shown the face of UAW, and you've made us proud of 602. 602 has always had a history of turning out excellent leaders, and we are glad and proud that you have made a good showing in the public of us, and good luck in your career and continued success. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek.
Thanks, Mel. I'm certainly not worthy of all of those accolades, but I'll accept them anyway.